Absolutely intercultural.
Fullständig tvärkulturell.
Absolut interkulturell.
Absolutamente intercultural.
Absolutely intercultural.
Welcome to show number 122 of Absolutely Intercultural. In this show, we're going to be hearing about why knowledge of the local culture is important, but often forgotten, how different cultures understand the notion of a contract, what sort of intercultural problems business people have, the right and wrong way to express disagreement, and lots more. My name's Anne Fox, and this show is coming to you from Denmark. Before we start, I just wanted to ask if you've noticed that our website is now much more accessible on iPhones and iPods. Go to www.absolutely-intercultural.com and you'll see what I mean. Now, you may recall that in the past we've brought you tasters from various conferences on intercultural topics. And in this show, we're very lucky to have been given permission to bring you extracts from the recent online webinar organised by IATEFL's Business English Special Interest Group on the topic of intercultural communication. IATEFL is the International Association of Teaching English as a Foreign Language, and IATEFL has many special interest groups, of which Business English is just one. Karl Daus in Germany was the organiser of this recent webinar, and you can see the full recordings on the BSIG website at bsig.org, and they're also on YouTube. We'll start with an important observation from Bao Quan Liu, based in China, who was talking about how to test intercultural competence in his students, when he mentioned something which is often absolutely overlooked.
I think a lot of scholars have been doing research in this field, but normally they focus on the foreign culture. For example, in China, they just include the foreign culture in their test. But in my point of view, Chinese culture should be also included. For example, here now we have different cultures here. We have a lot of participants from the world. And then sometimes if you are developing your test, maybe you can also include your local culture. Because the students are able to, for example, Chinese students, they are able to deal with not only the foreign culture, they know more about foreign culture. At the same time, they should be familiar with the Chinese culture as well. But here, well, it's one of the weaknesses in China now. Sometimes we focus too much on the foreign culture.
So could you describe your own local culture? Bao Quan also included a very interesting case study at the end of his talk, which would be a great starting point for a discussion. You can see the case study on the bsig.org website, where the recording and slides are available free of charge. For our next segment, we're going to go absolutely contractual and find out some of the problems various business people operating across cultures experience with one of the basics of business, the contract. Listen as Evan Frendo, an intercultural trainer, talks about some of the problems he hears about with contracts and why the last thing you want to do is have a lawyer in the room when hammering out the details.
And these are quotes from various business people I've worked with over the years. This is a typical one where a business person says he received this surprising comment from his business partner in Asia. This was a European talking to an Asian. And the Asian says, I'm sorry, someone else has signed the contract. We have to renegotiate. And of course, for a European business person, or a Western, I should say, this might come as something of a surprise. And I've heard this time and time again. I've even heard it between Chinese people talking about other Chinese people. So what I've done here is taken these quotes, but I've taken away what country or what company they've come from, because they could actually come from anywhere. This is another perspective of some people's thoughts about contracts. It's just a piece of paper. It's meaningless. And contracts are about people, not about papers. And in fact, if you take that to its extreme, one party can see the other side as being obsessed with paperwork as opposed to with people. This is one which lots of us have probably experienced personally. Let's start the work. The contract is in the post. And I know I've certainly written for various publishers or worked with various companies, finished and being paid, and the contract has never arrived. And I'm sure that's an experience which all of us share. Here's another one. This is a complaint, really, but from it was a Western company. And it's just giving the perspective of what happens when the other side actually changes the rules or plays by different rules. So here what's happened is the other company has signed, and that's it. They just carry on doing their own thing. In other words, the contract to them appears to be meaningless, depending on which perspective you look at it. And of course, for the person who signed it from the original company, in other words, the person who wrote this, the issue is one that he has customers to deal with. He's just a middleman. He's buying products, building them together into some sort of product or service, and then passing them on to a customer. So changing contract rules doesn't only affect the partner you're dealing with, but it also carries on into the rest of the business network. And the response, of course, is that they're not flexible enough. They want to stick by the papers, by the details in the contract. This is another interesting one, I think, where the person, the buyer or the seller who's negotiating the contract comes back and says, I'm happy to work like this. I understand that the other side has different perspectives on contracts and plays by different rules, but it's my boss who can't accept that. And I have to play the rules according to my boss's game as well as to my negotiating partner's game. Here's one question people ask sometimes. Are they honest? People look at this as if to say, well, they're playing by different rules, therefore that has something to do with honesty. And perhaps one interpretation of this is not to say they are honest or dishonest, but just to look at different rules for what is right and wrong. Some countries and some cultures just interpret things differently. I love this one. I said to one manager the other week, in fact, this is quite a recent one, and I said, well, why don't you just take a lawyer in if these contracts are so complicated or difficult to tie down? And he said, well, if we take a lawyer with us, he just advises us not to do business. And that just doesn't solve the problem. We still have to do business. We have to find a way to work with people whose perspective of contracts is different. And there's another one. They have the wrong priorities. The other side has the wrong priorities. Now, what this actually means when we have all these perspectives is that there's a certain amount of tension in any contract negotiation, any contract relationship. For example, one side might see the contract as a framework, whereas the other side might see the contract as the details which will lead, if necessary, to a court of arbitration. Another perspective is to say that a contract is between people and not between companies. Another one, contracts are unimportant. It's about trust and personal relationships. And the fourth one is that the contract itself is seen as inflexible and can't deal with the changes that happen in everyday business nowadays. And so people are flexible, and let's just not use the contract. So there are lots of different tensions here. Now, there are other issues as well, besides these perspectives from the people who are actually working with these negotiations. One, of course, is the whole point about legal terminology. Now, we all, as business English teachers, probably struggle with some of these words and some of this terminology. But the main issue is, as soon as you cross a border, people are working to different legal rules, jurisdictions, different backgrounds, different historical reasons for doing something in a certain way. And so very often the contract just means something completely different, even if it can be translated.
The next speaker in the webinar was Sabrina Gerland, an American based in Germany for the last 30 years, who spoke about the crucial importance of tone and expression. In this segment, Absolutely Problematic, Sabrina starts by listing the types of real-life questions which German business people present her with during her training sessions.
I begin the training by asking people, why is it that you're in the Culture and Communication Training seminar? Why did you book it? But one of the other things that we often hear, or at least I do, is the statement, we need intercultural communication training because they don't understand us. They'll say things like, well, in a project, how do I get an American to commit? Or how do I tell a client or a colleague that their proposal is not good? Now, when I hear these questions, of course, I still find them rather general. So I ask many more questions. And basically what comes out of it is I hear things like, how do I request politely but also clearly? And how can I get Americans to understand that I have made a request? And the next point with the disagreements, or the next question, how do I tell a client their proposal's no good? I hear things like, well, how do I disagree or criticize diplomatically? How can I get commitment when I disagree? And how do I motivate others to agree with my proposal? And I find these things very interesting, mainly because if you look at them, they're all language-based. And if I'm doing a two-day cultural communication training, it's rather difficult to do any kind of training with these issues here. I mean, I can talk about it, and I can explain to learners, you know, maybe perhaps some of the problems that they're having, but in order to really learn how to do these things, you need more time.
Now let's hear about how what you say can also be absolutely problematic, even when it is grammatically correct.
These are some examples of some disagreements, because they said that when they disagree with their clients or when they disagree with colleagues, that people don't quite understand them. Just to give you an example of the data that I'd collected, some of the ways that they disagreed with a client about an R&D solution. The client said, I'd like to have X, and the speaker, the German working professional, has to disagree with the idea. And they said, well, that's not a good idea. In our experience, that doesn't work. Or, I'm afraid I have to disagree. Or, that's a great idea. I really like it, but it won't work. Oh, and by the way, in these situations, the customer made a comment, the client made a comment, or made a proposal, and the German working professional then responded. And their responses, the disagreement came at the very, very beginning part of their response. In other words, they uttered the disagreement very directly. Research has shown that English speakers tend to avoid explicit acts of disagreeing. So saying, I have to disagree, is something that probably wouldn't happen very often within Americans if they're disagreeing with somebody. They've also found that when people soften pre-disagreeing acts, they're usually followed by a tentativized act of disagreeing. So if we look at, that's a great idea, I really like it, but it won't work, that breaks that rule right there. In other words, Americans would probably say, that's a great idea, I really like it, but I'm not quite sure how we're going to apply that idea. And that would, of course, gelt a disagreement.
You can hear more examples of communication going wrong and how to correct it by listening to the whole of Sabrina's talk on the BSIC.org page. So far we've heard about very specific aspects of intercultural communication in business. Be aware of the local culture. What do you understand by the word contract? And how can you express disagreement politely? Our next segment, Absolutely Mindful, will bring this all together. Peter Franklin, the final speaker in the BESIC webinar, presented results of extensive research into what he calls intercultural interactive competence. He then pulled it all together into an idea called mindfulness.
So how do you do mindfulness? How do you do intercultural business communication? Well, the first answer for us is focus with understanding on the cultural context and on the individual cultural identity of the person you're dealing with, and also, of course, their personality, but individual cultural identity. If we look at, go on and see that man called Bill Gudekunst, the late Bill Gudekunst, again, an American communication scientist, brought out the following important aspect of intercultural management communication. When we interact with strangers, we become mindful of our communication. Our focus, however, is usually on the outcome rather than the process of communication. And this is something that is particularly true in my experience of international managers. I've coached about 150 international managers in the meantime. One thing that one notices is that they're extremely outcome-oriented, extremely goal-oriented, and they want to get there. And I think this pointing out this point that Bill Gudekunst makes here is absolutely key, that we should be concentrating not only on the outcome but on the process. The research shows, incidentally, that the successful manager is extremely goal-oriented. In contrast, the successful international manager is slightly less goal-oriented than the domestic high-performance manager. He or she has learned the importance of focusing on the process of communication rather than just on getting there, just getting it to the outcome. Focus with understanding on the process of communication and cooperation as well as on the outcome. That's what we mean by mindfulness. That's the term that we use to try and get a handle on this plethora of individual competencies which is quite difficult to handle, and which, if we have mindfulness in mind, can enable us to get the message across, in particular to international managers who tend to be in rather a hurry.
One of the great joys of this webinar was the constant reference to real life, real people, and real situations. So in our next segment, Absolutely Short Term, we'll hear why the usual advice to nurture long-term relationships in order to build trust in business may not actually work.
If we look at market pressure nowadays, certainly a lot of the books on how to do intercultural communication talk about, well, we have to build up relationships. We have to allow time, perhaps, to understand the other side. But the reality of the market is that there's really never enough time to understand your business partner. This is something a businessman wrote to me in an email. Long-term relations don't exist in the real world. It's about money and profit, pure and simple. Now, if that is true, then the whole idea of trying to make allowances for other people's cultures and the way they build relationships as opposed to the way our culture builds relationships becomes questionable. Here's another one which is related to this. Teams, and these are sales teams, are changing so fast with companies, and this is often done as a strategy. It's done on purpose so that the people involved don't build up these personal relationships. Now, this creates incredible amount of pressure. Companies, from a company perspective, they say, we don't want these people to get to know and love each other, because if they do, then the contracts won't be as hard and as tight as they might be, or the deals. But on the other side, it's still people relating with other people.
And talking of real-world problems, I'm going to end the extracts from this webinar with a lovely case study, an incident related by one of Sabrina Gerland's course participants. I think we have to call this segment Absolutely German.
And imagine the following situation. You and your colleague are preparing a company presentation for a group of potential clients. Your American colleague thinks it would be a good idea for the presentation team to wear Lederhosen and Dirndl as a way to focus on German culture, and you disagree. This situation, by the way, is a true situation. It was presented to me in a culture and communication seminar when I asked, what kind of difficulties do you have you experienced? And this situation came up. The German wanted to know why it is that Americans think that Germans run around in Lederhosen and Dirndl all the time. And of course, he didn't like the idea of presenting his company, or let's say presenting the company in that kind of clothing, because he came from Frankfurt, and that kind of clothing is more common in Bavaria. And even still, perhaps a Bavarian company might say, I don't really want to present my company in this kind of clothing.
So my thanks to Karl Daus, the organizer of this wonderful and free webinar, for allowing me to bring you some extracts today. You'll find links to the speakers and other resources on our blog at www.absolutely-intercultural.com, where you can also leave us a comment. Did you like this taste of an online conference? Do you know of any other relevant upcoming online meetings? Do you have an idea for a show or a segment of a show? Do get in touch if you've got something to say about the podcast. And don't forget that if you catch the show online, it's now very easy to do so on your iPhone or iPod. Well, that's it for this show. The next one will be coming to you from Germany on November the 26th with Laurent Borgmann. Stay tuned.
Absolutely intercultural.
Fullständig tverkulturell.
Absolut interkulturell.
Absolutamente intercultural.
Absolutely intercultural.